Hello and welcome to Talking Scared. I'm your host, Neil McRobert, and this week is the start of a summer full of short stories. Lots to come on that front. But we start with the frankly stellar work of LP Hernandez. LP is a San Antonio-based author whose new collection, No Gods, Only Chaos, comes out in a few weeks. We're getting a head start, but no spoilers, so don't worry. It's a collection that runs the whole board of horror, from dark folkloric fantasy to Dust Bowl ghouls and some extreme home invasion depravity. Fun for all the family. LP has also brought out a novella this year, In the Valley of the Headless Men, which I've already included in my list of best horror of the year for Esquire. It's a dizzying, bewildering trip to the Nahanni Valley, the titular Valley of Headless Men. And I can't wait for you all to dash to Wikipedia off the back of this episode. We talk about both of those releases in a conversation that balances story insight with craft advice. How to write emotion and character concisely, using action within metaphor, the presence, or lack thereof, of military vets in horror, and when exactly LP knew he was becoming a better writer. If you're starting out as a storyteller, I think you'll find this episode quite enlightening and inspirational. And if you do get that kind of buzz from this show, and if you want more, consider joining up as a patron. You get loads of bonus stuff, I refuse to use the word content, including some extra conversation with LP and last week's guest, Robert O'Tone. That's going live on the Patreon this week. Just go to patreon.com/talkingscaredpod. Sign up, feel good about yourself for really helping, and enjoy. But now, come with me to the wild north of Canada. Take in the views, soak up the tranquility, but be careful not to lose your head. Let's talk scared. Hello, LP. Big welcome to the show. How are things with you?
Things are great. We just missed a storm here in San Antonio, so hopefully internet on my side holds up.
You say a big storm. Like, you're in Texas, so big means different things. How big a storm are we talking?
Potted plants knocked over, that level of big.
Okay. For Texas, that sounds fairly middling. I imagine, like, roofs being ripped off is a big storm.
Yes, I didn't wake up from it. I just saw the in quotes, devastation in the backyard.
Okay. Right. Yeah, we've had a plant shaker over here as well. So anything I can get in my tiny corner of the world doesn't feel big for Texas. But point taken with the internet, hopefully we'll sail through. As you mentioned, you're in San Antonio, and it's a city I visited many, many moons ago. Loved it. But, I mean, you're part of a genuine pool of talent bubbling up down there. I was thinking, like, there's yourself, there's Max Booth, Johnny Compton, Celso Hurtado. Is there something in the Texan water?
You know, I don't know. It's a really good crew here. We have even a few up in Austin. And then Chris, who I think you just interviewed, came down from Dallas yesterday to launch his book at Ghoulish Books. I don't know if it's in the water or we all just, you know, I think the center of gravity is Max. Honestly, he's kind of the glue that holds us together.
Max and Ghoulish Books, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I want to make a pilgrimage there one day. It only seems right because, as you say, he's such a linchpin. But no, I do love San Antonio. Like I said, I went there when I was, because it's like 20 years ago now. I thought it was amazing then. So hopefully I'm going to try and get back at some point to a book fest or other. But enough about me, right? This has been a very big year for you so far, and we're only like 5 months in, and you've released not only your novella In the Valley of the Headless Men, but also a collection of stories that will be coming out a very few weeks after this podcast goes live. That's called No Gods, Only Chaos. Both of those are great titles. We're going to discuss both today. I'll probably focus a little more on the collection because it's new and it's varied and in parts it's desperately upsetting. But let's start with the novella. Can you give us a brief introduction to your very weird story In the Valley of the Headless Men?
So this is a story I've tried to write multiple times. I think this is maybe the fifth iteration of it. I think there's actually a 66,000 word version of this in some editor's inbox from years ago. I never received a response to it, which means it wasn't the right version of this story. You and I have chatted a little bit about the Nahanni Valley and kind of, I don't know, the seductive quality of it. Just for a brief background, it's this place in, I believe it's the Northwest Territories, it's extreme northern Canada, this park that has this lineage, this history, even predating, you know, the arrival of Europeans, of just some weirdness, like tales of giants, of plants that shouldn't be there, you know, that should grow in tropical locations. And then around the turn of the century, the story started of explorers and trappers going there and not coming back, only for their bodies to be discovered missing their heads. And there aren't many animals that would kill a person and then take the head and leave the body. So that added to the myths that were already there. Mm-hmm. And I think it was frequent enough that became its kind of alternate nickname and kind of, you know, the one that people probably know it more so than even the Nahanni is the Valley of the Headless Men. So I thought about this as this really untapped playground. I just didn't have the right idea for it. So churning things over in my head, I started to kind of put some characters in place that to me wrote from a more personal space. So in this, there's two brothers who are half brothers. They're have mostly been estranged, and they reunite following the death of their mother. The older brother, Oscar, who hasn't had the easiest life, while going through their mother's things, finds some letters from the younger brother, the main character, Joseph, from his father, which talks about this place and suggests, hey, if you're ever needing to find yourself, maybe check this out. Basically saying, I'm going on an adventure to the Nahanni Valley. And that just sparks the dialogue between the two of them. And they decide to go, like, to reunite as brothers there. Jillian has been kind of a fixture in Joseph's life, his first love, so to speak, and she invites herself along. When they get there, I feel like I'm just saying the whole thing, so I'll wrap it up here shortly and kind of lead into the mystery of it. Nahanni, to me, is it can be whatever you make it. So that's why I chose that place. And I just kind of pulled on a few of those threads, kind of added some of my own myths to it. But it really is the dynamic among these three people in this strange setting where anything can happen.
Right. You've said all the things there that I want to pick up on. So that's the perfect tee up for this interview, certainly for the little bit at the start about Nahanni Valley. For a start, listeners, when we had Jenny Kiefer on the show and I mentioned the Dyatlov Pass and I said, you know, everyone rush to Wikipedia if you don't know about the Dyatlov Pass. It's the same with the Nahanni Valley. If you're into creepy mysteries, you're welcome to the wiki hole that I'm going to send you on. It's a hell of a story. Do you remember when you first became aware of it?
I would say maybe in the 2000 teens. I'm not sure exactly where. I was really into reading books about, like, you know, out of place artifacts and stuff like that. And so that was kind of in that same, you know, ballpark.
Yeah. I mean, I've never read a piece of fiction that fully engages with the lore, because it's really unexplored territory, no pun intended, in horror. And even you, LP, in your way, skirt it in the main. You keep all of that legacy as texture rather than plot. Were you not tempted to lean more into such a ripe history, or did you actively want to carve your own route through it?
I think in prior versions, I did lean more into the weirdness, and in that abandoned novel, it deserved to be abandoned. There is a lot more of that, you know, kind of going through the caves and all that stuff. But I felt like, you know, the characters kind of got pushed to the background. And I guess for this version of the story, they needed to be right up front. And so I did want to have some fun and kind of explore some of those mysteries. And like I said, add my own lore, to it, but I didn't want the relationship between the brothers, the tension there. That to me is where the horror is. And cause I don't know, I would consider this horror light. There are a couple of a couple of graphic scenes, but for the most part, it's more, I think, from my perspective, when Oscar kind of shows himself a little bit, and then Joseph realizes that he's stuck, you know, at the top of the world with a person he doesn't really know. That knowledge, even though it's not upfront on every page, I think that's kind of the undercurrent that kind of propels the tension of the book.
Yeah, drama at the extremes of the world is always heightened, I suppose. And I'll talk about characters in a second, but when I read about the Nahanni, my feelings are poised between excitement and sadness from a storytelling and reader's perspective. Excitement, because it is largely virgin territory. And to my childlike brain, there could be anything up there. Bigfoot. But there's also sadness, because it doesn't feel, or, you know, it really feels to me like there are so few of those places left on Earth, so few pockets of the unknown for horror to map, don't you think?
Yeah, very much so. I feel, you know, not all the time, and not that I would have done it well, but sometimes you get the sense that you were born at the wrong time, like the age of exploration is over. And so your mind kind of drifts and wanders to these places that are, I don't want to say underexplored, because I prefer it to be that way. I think only about 1,000 people go there every year, if I remember correctly. And you feel like maybe you missed out on something. So yes, I totally agree.
I always think back to reading Conan Doyle's The Lost World. And obviously, as you grow up and you've become more aware, you become aware of like the colonial implications in that kind of fiction, and the fact, you know, all of that baggage comes along with it. And I almost wish there was a way that we could, you know, have a new undiscovered continent that you could write about free of all of that stuff that has marked historical novels, you know. And I was going to say Nahanni obviously gives as much of a chance of that as you can, but then that's completely dispensing with the indigenous population once again, because a big part of the lore of this part of the world is passed on by, is it the Diné tribe?
Correct. And that was something that I think I featured a little more prominently, but then in retrospect, in previous versions, in retrospect, I was like a little uncomfortable trying to tell someone else's story.
Yeah, I get that. Your Nahanni is a very blank canvas, and it's a stage for a very particular, very intimate story. And all the wonderful weirdness aside, what I really admired about the novella is how you do manage to build a deep sense of character in such a concise story. Because you've got this trio that you mentioned, Oscar, Joseph, and Gillian, and each of them has their own arc of grief and redemption, I suppose. And you're doing all of that whilst also sketching out this physical journey through weirdness. And it's a lot, LP, but unlike a lot of novellas, it never feels undernourished. So I suppose, from a craft perspective, what's your trick? How have you packed all that character in and still not diluted or dented the story?
Ooh, that's a good question. I guess I learned from my mistakes when I pushed beyond about the 40,000 word mark and felt like the scenes were less meaningful. Maybe there was more, you know, violence on the page. And I'm speaking about the novel version of this, but nothing was being done for the people on the page. They were just kind of going through it. And my second pass through this, or actually fifth, I think, yeah, there's been multiple attempts to get this right. I recognize that, you know, there is a story to tell, that I could keep having them go through things. There is another character, Sam, who shows up. He's also in previous versions of this. And I could make that journey with him longer and more complicated, but then I'm sort of hitting the same notes. So I felt like I did everything I wanted to do with the characters, and I kind of cut some of the fluff out that that didn't really impact kind of where they end up at the end of the story.
Okay. Yeah. I'm intrigued into how you knew this iteration was the one. What was it you responded to in this telling, where you're like, okay, yeah, I've done it right this time?
In the afterword, I mentioned that this is pulled from my relationship to my brother. We are half brothers. Of course, we don't think of ourselves that way. And we do have different fathers. We both have, you know, complicated relationships to our father. So that's very much my brother and I. And I think once the original characters were, I think, college kids, you know, on like a reverse spring break. Mm-hmm. Instead of going to South Padre, they go up to the Nahanni Valley. And I never connected with them, so it didn't even matter to me what happened to those characters. But once I started writing from out of my own sense of emotional baggage with my brother, he's a dyslexic. And at the time of his diagnosis, dyslexia wasn't understood in the way it is today. It was very much thought to be something, you know, wrong with the eyes. I remember him bringing home like these different, you know, colored laminated papers that were supposed to help him, or not papers, but see-through. They were supposed to help him read better. And he always, you know, struggled in school because, you know, that's, you know, one of the keys to success is reading and comprehension. And that's not just in English, that's in math as well. So I had a much easier time in school, and I've always carried that, I guess that fear with me that he would look at the paths our lives took and feel betrayed in some way by the universe. So writing from that perspective, it didn't even feel like writing. It was more almost like journaling through these characters.
Yeah, there is, I say there's an intimacy to it. Like when I reviewed the book, the thing I mentioned beyond all the horror stuff actually is, I think I used the phrase that you have a gift with grief or something like that. Because you do a particular thing several times in the book. You have this technique where you will center an emotion on an object. And the two that come to mind are a child's sock. And particularly, there's this idea of drinking the final glass of lemonade that the character's mother made before she passed away.
Mm-hmm.
There's a real efficient profoundness to that. They become a sort of physical shorthand for loss. And I thought that was a really useful technique to get across quite a weight of emotion in a very brief way.
I think from a writing perspective, if you're writing a scene and you can, instead of using, you know, purple prose or just as many adjectives as you can throw, because there are a lot for grief, you could, that's a deep well. If you can have the reader visualize, like having the two brothers at the dining room table and this mostly empty pitcher between them, or a character pulling out a sock. To me, that putting the imagery in your reader's mind does so much more than, you know, investing words just to describe grief in 10 different ways.
Yeah. Yeah. I read a brilliant quote from you in another interview during my research for this, where you said, it really struck me to my core. You said you mistook having a great vocab for being a great writer, and how not only are they not the same thing, a great vocabulary can actually get in the way of good writing sometimes.
Yeah, I've pretty much abandoned my thesaurus now.
Yeah, it's very true, though. Like, I have this shorthand on this podcast that I often use the word lush. It often means they use too many words there. I don't love it. I sometimes think, yeah, lushness gets in the way of a good story. It's a generalization, but
I am hoping to hear the word kudos just once, because I love the way you pronounce it.
Oh, you can have as much kudos as you want. Why do I not pronounce it properly?
No, it's just different, and I love it. I think it's almost like a kudos, and I say kudos, which sounds very American. It sounds like it should be a chip or something like that, like Fritos, kudos.
Oh, I say, what do I say? Kudos?
Yeah.
Honestly, you Americans are giving me real anxiety. I still, every time I use the word boogeyman, I have to like gird myself for it, because I can't remember who the conversation was with, but I was on a round table and I said boogeyman, and like four people just dissolved into laughter. So now I have to think constantly, boogeyman, and it's going to be kudos. Right, I'm going to think about that going forwards. Well, here we go. Right, more kudos for you.
Thank you.
The climax in this mysterious cave deep in the Nahanni. At that point, the book tips over into outright weird with a capital W. Cosmic, perhaps, you know, certainly reality bending. And like so much of the book, something you've already said, the book and than a handy. It's like a blank canvas upon which a reader can impose any real interpretation they like, I think. Is that what you want from that ending? Or is there a definite logic to that climax that must be grasped to understand the book?
So it's been interesting to kind of watch people's experience, because as I wrote it, mm-hmm. you know, I'm writing it iteratively, steps at a time, over a period of time. And so it makes sense. Like, the words on the page make sense to me, and I can visualize it. I understand what's happening. But then I, you know, once you send that out into the world, there's this whole, you know, great big unknown about how someone without that, you know, that those connections, you know, from the creative perspective, they don't have those when they're reading it. So it's being filtered and interpreted differently. And for some people, it's really resonated. I've gotten some wonderful feedback about it. Other people felt, you know, that it confused them. And so I did feel a little bummed about that. That's never my intent when I write. I want people to, you know, have a rewarding experience when they, and especially at the end of the book. And that's okay. If you were left with a feeling at the end of it, or maybe some striking imagery, or just kind of some questions, I think that's okay too. My intent is never to frustrate. From my perspective, those last sequences did make sense, but of course I wrote it. So, you know, that's obvious that would be the case.
Yeah. I fall in the middle of that because I was a bit bamboozled by it. I was a bit wrong footed. I was like, I'm not sure I've got it. It was like trying to grasp water, what I thought was going on right at the end. But that didn't feel like a weakness to me. I didn't feel unsatisfied. It felt like pulling back the veil. You know, if the Nahani is a thin place beyond which lies cosmic whatever, it felt like we'd peeked behind that veil, and that what you were seeing didn't need to necessarily make linear, logical sense. You know, I was okay with the chaos. And then you explained it a bit to me in a DM on Twitter. I was like, oh, okay. But that didn't make me like it more. It wasn't necessary to me. I was okay with the what I took as the chaos of the ending of that. Reminded me a little bit, here's a weird comparison, of when I first watched the film Arrival, which I don't know if you've seen or not.
Yes.
I didn't fully, my wife explained it to me because she's much smarter than me. I was a bit like, oh, okay. But I loved it without fully knowing why I loved it. And I would say the same for Nahani. So I wouldn't take people's confusion necessarily as a criticism.
Yeah, I didn't want to put any hard borders around it. We both agreed this is kind of underutilized territory in fiction in general. Mm-hmm. And so to say this is what it is instead of, you know, this is what it could be.
Whereas Headless Men leaves all that scope for ambiguity and debate over genre, you know, horror, weird, sci-fi. No Gods, Only Chaos is emphatically horror. And in fact, they don't really feel like they're necessarily written by the same person.
Thank you. I'm hoping, excuse me, as I'm reading through this collection myself and looking at the stories, that is something that people, a takeaway from them will be the diversity of voice. And I hope that creates an enjoyable reading experience, that even though they're all written by one person, mm-hmm. that they really run the gamut of horror.
They massively do. But here's what I'll say. They are all varied from each other, hugely so. But what I like about them, what unifies them, is that they are all what I would call concrete stories. So I have a bit of a problem with these, God, I make these statements, honestly, I sound like a right dick, but I much prefer a short story where when you finish it, you're like, I get that story. You have told me a story. Perhaps I'm a bit of an old fashioned coot, but I like to understand a short story rather than it being some always an experimental prose poem that I don't really get. So all of these are different, but they all have a unity of purpose in them. But you mentioned variety of voice. And, I mean, let's just take the first three stories, right? Because they're told respectively from the POV of a teenage boy, an old man lapsing into dementia, and a wildly neurodivergent serial killer. I'm assuming you intentionally reach for those varied perspectives.
So I think eight were written for different calls. And so like you said, my intent isn't to experiment if I'm writing for a call, because it's probably not going to rise to the top. I can't imagine an editor reading something that's very experimental and saying, yeah, this makes sense in our collection. So I tried to write within the confines of the call, but to do something different with it. So the strength of voice matters. And my goal in writing for any kind of call is, you know, I want mine to stand out in some way, because if you're writing for a zombie call, you know, there's so many, that's been done so many times. So to make it any different, you know, you have to either a new setting, a new perspective, just something that the editor who might receive 500 hasn't seen before.
So when you see a call, you're like, yeah, okay, I want to write for that. What do you do? How do you set about finding that new angle? What's your process to coming up with an idea to fit a brief?
So Cemetery Joe, I think that was my that's the first story in the collection. That was the first time I was very deliberate. I have a couple in this collection that were published prior to that, that were below like the propay mark. Cemetery Joe was the first propay market I actually isolated and said, I'm going to write for this propay market in the hopes that I'll get enough of these that I could be like an HWA active member. And so I tried to write past my own comfort level, which was new for me. I think you can write a coherent story that makes sense. All the parts are there. And, you know, everything, like you said, it's a self-contained experience. You don't need any additional information. So within that construct, you still do have room to either be funny or extreme. So like with Cemetery Joe, the call was for Picnic in the Graveyard. So these were all, you know, graveyard themed stories. And I knew there were going to be, you know, people coming out of graves. I knew there was going to be probably zombies. So you kind of imagine, you know, this editor is going to receive several hundred stories that say 50% of them might fall in this trope. So what I tried to do was write something that nobody else was going to write and make sure the writing is still good, but it should be a one-off because, I mean, from a realistic standpoint, you know, they can't have five stories of zombies crawling out of graves. They could probably only have one unless they like bookend the collection. So if your story is the only story of its type, it eliminates a lot of the competition or makes it, you know, as they're kind of weighing one story against another. Well, we already have this zombie story. This I've never seen before.
Mm. Yeah, well, I imagine they haven't because it features a character that was once known as Corpse Fucker Joe. So
yes,
it reads as kind of like a statement of intent for the collection as well. So I wondered, I now sense you put it there just because it was the first story that you sold to a pro market, but I did wonder if you'd put it first in the collection to kind of stick a flag in the ground and be like, you know, no quarter here.
Yeah, pretty much.
I'm going to ask you something now that I know you get asked a lot. And I think the reason you get asked a lot is because there aren't many people who can answer the question. But you are a medical officer for the US Air Force. Is that right? Medical officer?
Correct.
And how long have you been in the Air Force?
It will be 18 years in July.
Well, I mean, I can only vouch for how handsome you look in your dress uniform. I saw you for the gala at Stokecon, and my God, you strike a dashing figure.
You're going to see it again.
Excellent. Good to know. I'll put a photo online. But I was thinking about that, and initially, I was going to say, for all of these voices and the ventriloquism that you do in this collection, I was going to say there's an absence of vets. And then I reflected on your story, Return of the Champion, which is about a man returning from many, many lost years in space, and he comes back, let's just say he comes back changed. I don't want to push this too far, but I wondered if that was in some way a sideways examination of the veterans' experience and particularly the experience of families.
I don't think that was my intent when I wrote it, and that is, it's kind of the rewarding experience of of having a little bit of detachment from some of these stories and then reading them again a year or two later, and then just connecting my reading experience to different moments in my life. And so, yes, I do think in retrospect, not actively when I wrote it, but there's a lot of, it very much mirrors my life, except, you know, I haven't been gone for years on a space expedition. I have been gone for, you know, several, many months, over half a year at times, and various points where a couple of months, a few weeks. The longer duration separation, it's always happy at first, you know, the welcome home. We have videos of me going into my kids' classrooms. You know, you've seen those welcome home videos, and I like to watch them, you know, like the anniversary of my longer deployment. I like to watch those videos, but then there is that kind of reconnecting, like the world didn't stop when you were gone. There are new patterns that develop. There's, you know, your kids grew up a little bit, and especially, you know, when they're so young, 6 months is a huge chunk of time. So you're stepping into an environment that is different than the one that's in your memories, and just having to adjust to that. And then, you know, in the Air Force, you don't have a lot of time to adjust. Usually within a couple of weeks, you're back at work. So I think that might have been at the very, very far back of my mind when I wrote it definitely made a lot more sense rereading the story a couple of years after.
On a slightly sillier note, it also delighted me, that story, because it kind of reads like, what if the people from the movie Event Horizon made it home?
It's a huge source of inspiration. I'm always pulling from Event Horizon. That's like probably top five as far as, oh shit, I'm doing Event Horizon again.
Really? Because I even wondered whether it was, this is a bit left field, whether it was an inspiration on Headless Men, the ending of that. It feels, there's something about it. Again, that mind-bending, this is not the rules of the universe we understand. It felt that way.
Yes, the chaos engine that's mentioned, that very much inspired.
Yeah, okay. It's such a good film, right? I just think it's still, even though we all love it in the horror community, it's still such an underappreciated gem, that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Nightmarish. But to stay with this, if you don't mind, just this question of the military and of veterans for a minute. Military personnel and vets seem particularly underrepresented in horror, both on and off the page. Now, I know that your protagonist in your novella Stargazers is a veteran, for example, but do you see an absence of colleagues on and off the page? Because I just don't... I would imagine it would permeate the genre, and it just seems to be the complete opposite.
Yeah, I guess I do. And then when you do see it represented, it's almost, I wouldn't say it's poorly executed. It doesn't feel integral, like the most recent season of True Detective, which, you know, as far as, you know, I don't feel like I understood every minute of it, but like you, I enjoyed the journey that I was on. I'm forgetting the character's name, the police officer with, not Jodie Foster's character, the other
Navarro.
One. Yeah. There were some, you know, some flashback scenes, and it felt like it was, you know, desert, and I didn't fully understand how that connected to the story they were trying to tell. And so I feel like it can be used as a device to explain someone's behavior. And I would say the military is a hugely diverse, it's society, just we're in uniforms, and our experiences vary widely. There's a huge, I would say, I don't know about majority, but especially since, you know, some of our operations have wound down, there's not as much of a footprint overseas. So some people will go their whole careers and never deploy. 98% will probably never see combat. So that isn't the reality for most of us, but for most of us, we do experience being away, being separated, being isolated. And I think that's kind of the loneliness is something I do try to access in my fiction. And because the other side of it, you know, I know peripherally, but I don't want to say that's my experience or claim some some stake in it that's just not true for me.
Yeah. And I wonder sometimes whether horror authors who've had those experiences, particularly conflict experiences, feel like the genre would in some way trivialize the real hardship of those environments. I don't know, but I just do know that it feels like being ex-military in fiction is far too often an absolute shorthand for has PTSD and aggression problems.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Yeah. And that's, you know, you mentioned the Stargazers, and that's something that I actually did receive feedback from fellow veterans that this is more accurate. It's not something that necessarily dominates every phase of your life.
Yeah.
But it's something that, you know, it's the wounds are oftentimes invisible. And so it's something that definitely affects your life, not necessarily every moment of it, but that I think is the more universal experience for many military personnel. The combat is a very, you know, it's very particular. That not a whole lot of people experience that, but that is overrepresented in media.
Yeah, Pete, have you read John Milas's The Militia House? It's supposed to be fantastic. I haven't read it yet.
I did, actually. I think I read that maybe February or so of this year. And it's you know, as far as what I liked about it is the kind of unflinching portrayal of the strange, I don't even know how to say this properly. I remember one scene where I think the main character is filling out something like a safety report by firelight. And it's because some commanding officer somewhere said, we all need to take these surveys. Mm-hmm. And it's like they're in a combat zone. There's, you know, stuff happening. And then they're all by campfire filling out a safety report or safety survey. That kind of the ridiculous, you know, the stuff filtering down from the top.
Yeah.
Seeing the impact at the front lines of that moment, you know, in their full combat gear. That really, really resonated. The loneliness, the isolation, and those, you know, really, what am I even doing moments.
Yeah. Yeah. I can only imagine. Like, listeners, I am intrigued by this question about the paucity of vets and that sort of topic in horror. So I can only really think of Peter Straub's Coco. So if you know anything that I should read, let me know. But let's push on with this collection into the really fun stuff, the awful hardcore stuff. In the afterword, LP, you say, and this is a quote, you tend to pull back from the precipice in your stories, that you hold back from showing the worst. And I call absolute bullshit, because there are at least three stories in this book that go very, very hard indeed. I mean, we started off with a story featuring a character called Corpse Fucker Joe, and that's nowhere near the worst. There is a pair of stories, Bystander and Family Annihilator, that are two of the most vicious, verging on sadistic things I've read on this entire show. Maybe I'm just soft, but it feels like that you and Max Booth are, you know, working in tandem here almost. Is he an influence on these stories?
He's an influence as a very dear friend. But,
okay. Oh, yeah, got it.
So I will correct myself to say, prior to this collection, and if you I have two others. If you read those, you may not see that same unflinching like violence on the page. I can remember specific stories where I intended to push past, you know, that my discomfort about what I was about to write. Mm-hmm. And then I turned away from it. I couldn't even write it. And so Cemetery Joe was me pushing past. And then a lot of the stories I wrote after that were, you know, it was fun. Honestly, it was really fun story to write. And then it was successful. And I, you know, as far as like giving advice for short story writers, I think if you find yourself holding back, then, you know, there's a potential you're limiting where the story can go.
Well, you don't hold back. And give my listeners, because I'm talking too much, give my listeners just the barest thing they need to know about Bystander and Family Annihilator, and then let's talk about them.
So The Bystander I wrote for the Human Monsters anthology, and for me, it was trying to get in the headspace of a person who, man, I feel like I almost gave away kind of a little spoiler there. I did want to do a serial killer type, but as I mentioned earlier, I didn't want to do the typical serial killer type. So I wanted to lean into the humor of it. I didn't intend for this to be a humorous story when I wrote it, but it was from the first page that's where I decided I wanted to take it. And I wanted to make people uncomfortable with what they found funny. So, I was, as far as, you know, writing for a call and understanding what the competition is, I didn't imagine there were going to be too many stories with a serial killer that watched his mom die in a bathtub and be more concerned about having tater tots at school on Friday. So I definitely wanted it to stand out for the right reasons. And like I said, that was the second story I wrote where I was kind of like, gloves are off. Mm-hmm. And man, they came all the way off.
And then Family Annihilator is just so much worse, because you said a bit in the afterword to both of these, you mentioned humor, and I can see the humor in The Bystander. It's the most, you know, modern humor you can imagine, but it's there. But you said that about Family Annihilator, and I could not see the humor. Although, could I? Because the dad jerking off in the car, in the car park of his office, when I think about it, is kind of funny.
Yeah, and him being like, knowing that he didn't. So in the beginning, he's kind of reflecting that he's invaded this home, and he intended to knock somebody out with one punch, but he missed. And so now he's going to be thinking about that all day, that he had this awkward eye contact with his victim. And he's really obsessed with the fact that the son has a last name, Christopher, spelled with a K, and doesn't understand why that is, because, you know, is it a family thing? And it's just a fixation on that is so outside of the violence that's happening, to me, was the humorous part.
Well, is that what you mean when you say that, again, after, like, story notes are just an absolute treat for an interviewer because it does half our work for us. But in the story note to Family Annihilator, you say that you enjoyed being in the headspace of someone incapable of empathy. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's almost, I would imagine, like an actor does when you're trying to get into a role of something that is totally disconnected from who you are as a person. Mm. But it's kind of, I don't want to say fun, because I feel like that's going to get me on a list, but it's so foreign for me to be in that headspace. And because when I'm writing, I'm imagining myself in that room and having these conversations and moving around. And so it's almost, yeah, I almost said fun again, but it is fun knowing that this is something that hopefully has never really happened. And we can just, you know, look at the worst of humanity on a page and then the story's over and everybody's safe.
But that's a trick for you as well, right? Because it's one thing to want to inhabit the headspace of a character who has no empathy, but for the story to land, it entirely depends upon the reader's empathy, because you basically put a mother in a truly terrible, impossible situation where she's forced to make an awful choice. I shall say no more. And we have to really feel like the abject horror that she feels. So you have to be aware of that as well when you're doing it. So you've got to presumably, you know, do the empathy thing whilst writing from a position of a lack of empathy. It must be quite a juggling trick.
Yeah, I think when I'm putting myself in my character's headspace, if I can feel that terror, then I know I'm doing it right and not just kind of going through the motions. Mm. And as a parent, that is your greatest fear is, you know, your children being put at risk, and it's completely outside of your control. So writing it, that's not hard to do because that's something I fear every day.
Mm. And it's such a twisted, intricate scenario that you set up. It's like the world's most evil Rube Goldberg machine, right? And
yes.
I'm not trying to get you on a list here, LP, I promise, but how did you create it? I mean, I'm sort of amused by the idea, I suppose, of you actively sitting down to go, right, I am going to conjure up the worst scenario I can think of. Is that what you did?
Pretty much. I think that powerlessness is the worst feeling you could probably ever feel, like in the pit of your stomach. And so I just put a couple of, you know, limitations on the character, just somewhat for plot and kind of to keep me moving forward for this character. This isn't the first time he's done this, but when he does it, he doesn't bring any weapons into the house with him. And so he can only use what's available and what's around for his own, you know, kind of purpose, which it's kind of hinted at, but it's not fully explored. And so, yeah, that kind of does lead into the Rube Goldberg scenario where he chooses to execute this act only with kind of what's in the house. So yeah, awful concept. And then just for plot purposes, adding a few limitations, and then the story kind of wrote itself.
Wow. It's obviously, you know, horror fans, we endlessly tussle with that question that we get asked by people who don't understand the genre. You know, why do you like this stuff? What do you get from this stuff? Why is it fun? And when you read a story like Family Annihilator, I at times didn't want to carry on reading. I was like, I actually don't want to know what happens next, but I'm compelled to know what happens next. And there is unavoidably a fun in that, else we wouldn't carry on reading, right? And it's far too broad a thing for me to come up with a coherent, singular question, but do you get what I'm getting at about this story? It stands as an emblem of that, of the absolute tension of horror, of wanting to carry on reading, but also not.
It's kind of like Martyrs without the payoff, because, you know, and I've heard you reference this movie, so I know you're familiar with it. There's the first two thirds of it is just this extreme kind of brutal violence, but then we have this relief valve of the story going this completely different direction. And I think at the end of that, you know, as extreme as it goes, we feel okay. Like, okay, this had a bigger purpose and a bigger meaning. And then for something like Family Annihilator, the only relief is really those moments of humor that you can walk away from it and feel like I'm not a bad person for having read this because I did laugh a couple of times.
Yeah, you are right. I mean, Martyrs is the only horror film I've ever had to walk out of in the cinema. I couldn't, basically. It just, wrong day, wrong feeling, wrong vibe. I just walked away from it. And now I know too much about it. It's not worth putting myself through it because I know every beat of that movie. So like, there's no mystery left. There's only horror. So it's probably not for me. This is much closer to the nihilism of something like The Strangers. You know, why are you doing this? Because you were home, which is one of the great lines in horror cinema, yeah. Right?
Yes, totally agree.
It works. It would be a good thing to, as a good debating tool for why we love horror in all its problematic, difficult, challenging guises. Before we finish with this, do you have any stories in this collection that you love that I haven't asked you a question about? Do you have a favorite that I haven't addressed?
I don't know if I have. It's hard to pick a favorite. I would say where I felt like I pivoted from an average story writer into, you know, I feel like I'm about to sound too egotistical, but like a really good story writer.
Can I guess?
Was from the red dirt. Sorry,
that's,
I said
I,
it.
No,
as
that's what were. I was going to say. That's what I was going to say. From the red dirt. Yeah. Why is that? This is a story of kind of zombies in the Dust Bowl, right? Why did that feel like a pivot point or a leap forward?
I guess I can look at the stuff I'd written before then, and which it would be several dozen stories. I have two collections prior to this one. And I felt that I was writing this from a different place. And we kind of talked about this, you know, story structure. You can have a beginning, middle, and end. It kind of hits every note. It does what it's supposed to do as a story. But for this one, it was the first time I tried to write with a different voice that wasn't my own. And I was consistent with it. So that to me was a challenge because I was afraid it would come off as fake. You know, I'm not a 12-year-old boy in the Dust Bowl. I've read, you know, my share of texts from the time, but I wasn't worried about how educated he would sound. That was, you know, he talked about my previous comments of knowing too many words or using too many words. That wasn't right for this story, but I used to think that's what good writing was the fanciest words I could use. But for this story, it was, you know, very blunted speech and very kind of rapid and quick. But also kind of mixing that with a little bit of, minus the couple of stories you've mentioned. I always have some heart in the center of kind of any work, unless I'm writing about a family annihilator. And to me, that was the very center of this story was love. There was just this kind of confusion around it, because it is about a grandfather coming back from the dead, and his purpose really isn't understood until the end. They're just dealing with a decomposing corpse still kind of going through the motions of his daily life. And at the end of it, it makes sense why he did it. So there is really just a kind of a bleak sense of not knowing until kind of some of the threads come together.
It's such a beautiful story. And it does feel like a pivot point in the collection, because we get Cemetery Joe, we have a story called Hesitation Cuts, which is bleak body horror, beautifully done, mm-hmm. and The Bystander. And they're three quite harsh stories. And then From the Red Dirt sort of flowers out, and there's a depth of character, and it's a bit more expansive. And I would have guessed that was the story that was closest to your heart. If someone put a gun to my head, I'd have put my money on that one.
You guessed right.
Yeah, and I just love Dust Bowl horror as well, right? I mean, there's not enough of it. It's such a ripe, how bad a pun is that? Such a fertile ground for horror, but it really is. Have you ever read Mr. Shivers by Robert Jackson Bennett?
I knew you were going to mention a book I'd never read, and no, I haven't. You're so much smarter than me, Neil.
Well, it's not smart. I've read a lot of books, and like, you know, we can all. It doesn't quite equate to smarter. It just means I've wasted a lot more time reading a lot more books. I've not written books, LP, for a start. Quite a lot of time saved there. But no, that's a Dust Bowl horror novel. It won the Shirley Jackson, I think, about these like hobos who are tracking down this supernatural boogeyman, who is kind of riding the rails and killing families. It's really good.
Right up my alley, yeah.
Yeah, I think the author's from Louisiana, so it's got a certain sort of flavour as well. I recommend that one. So we've talked about a lot of awful things today. I've kind of forced you to. But before, you know, my listeners are convinced that we are both worrisome people, I want to finish with the beauty of this collection. Now, I'm not trying to make you blush, right, but you have away with metaphor and simile. I already mentioned the object as grief technique in Headless Men, but check this out in this collection, listeners, right? This is from three different stories. Amidst all the awfulness, an old couple, quote, circle each other like enemy ships without munitions. A corpse's head, quote, snaps back like a broken dandelion. I love that. And in one, perhaps my favourite, a certain house, quote, didn't feel like a home, but like a box placed over something dangerous. There's a real agility with figurative language, LP. Does it come natural to you, or is that the final result of all the sweat and grind we don't see?
Sometimes it does, and it's kind of surprising when it happens. But I will say my editing process is a little different. So that could come out, you know, first draft. Mm-hmm. I often, when I write a story, if I'm coming back to it, I'll go back three pages and I'll look for moments like that. So that initially that the line about the house could have been just a descriptive one talking about, you know, the ceiling sagging or, you know, missing shingles. And I'm like, I can picture it, but it doesn't mean anything. It's just, you know, those are just words, but I can visualize that action of boxing up something dangerous. For me, I probably go to, like, you know, when you see a scary spider in your house, you'll throw mm-hmm. something over it real quick. So I'm always looking for moments where if I said something that was descriptive, could I have made it active?
Right. Okay. What does that do? Does that make it more, does it do more work in the story then?
It's hard to picture adverbs and adjectives. And I think even in Stephen King's On Writing, he talks about, and this, it's been probably decades since I read it, but kind of one of the exercises he goes through is, I believe it's a woman like walking, and it's maybe there's some high heels and it describing like the sound and the effect of the people around her on mm-hmm. her presence, on her walking through. You can describe a high heel as being red and looking like an apple and all this stuff, but to make it move, I think that makes it move in the reader's mind. Describing a shoe as bright red as an apple or lacquered or however you want to describe it, that's a static image. But like putting a box over something scary, that has some motion to it. So for me, when I write a story, I want people to, you know, kind of imagine this, the movement in their mind. And so I've really gotten away from just trying to find new ways to describe things because it's all been done, and try to find more active ways to describe things because, I think to your question, yeah, it does do something for the story. People are going to be, I hope, more invested in something that they can see moving through their head.
Mm. That's interesting. That's a good bit of craft advice. I collect them like charms.
So that worked. You just said collect them like charms, and immediately I saw like a charm bracelet.
Oh, okay.
So, there you go.
See, I'm a natural too. No, seriously though, the level of I don't want to say description now because it's not, is it? But the level of metaphor and simile is very impressive in these stories. In stories that are quite, you'll know what I mean when I say this, quite unliterary in the lack of pretension, if that makes sense. Mm. These are not pretentious mm-hmm. stories at all. There's these brief flurries of poetry which are reminiscent of the kind of thing that King himself does in his short fiction. So mm-hmm. yeah, I'm with that. Final wrap up questions, LP. This conversation has flown by. Do you have a book you'd like to recommend for my listeners?
Knowing this question is coming, and I wanted to say this at the beginning, it really is an honor to be on here with you, Neil. I've been listening, longtime listener. So this is a big moment for me. I just did want to say that, and please don't edit it out. Please leave it in. There's a lot of pressure with this. I've been kicking this around for a while now. But what I landed on was Kelsea Yu's Bound Feet, which is a novella. It's in the My Dark Library line. And it is about two women who sneak into these Chinese gardens in Portland. They're celebrating the life of one of the children of one of the mothers, or one of the characters who drowned there. And it is, we talked about like economy, you know, in writing novellas. This, I would say, I read the first 30 pages kind of nodding my head and I was enjoying it. And this took such a pivot and did so much in the remaining 70 pages. It covers lore, grief, ghosts, betrayal. And I felt like it was a novel that took all of the excess and just stripped it away. But somehow, to use your word, it still feels lush. So that is Bound Feet by Kelsea Yu.
Okay. Brand new one on me. So always good to hear. Yeah. Thank you for that. That can go straight in the show notes. And listeners, I am still working on this grand unifying web page of cross-referenced book titles, but God, it's a lot of work. There's been a lot of books talked about on this show. So for now, keep checking the show notes and they're all there. But thank you for that, LP. Last question. This one has been slightly tweaked from when you started listening to the show, but same rules apply. What was the last thing that truly scared you? Film, book, media, real life, whatever you want.
The scariest thing in the world to me is teenagers. especially male teenagers, because oftentimes they have man-sized bodies, but they don't have man brains. They have underdeveloped brains. And so I was a couple weeks ago taking my dogs for a walk, and we have these waterways behind, you know, the subdivision, mm-hmm. walking paths. Very, you know, when you're walking through it, it feels like you're miles from anything, but it's, you could really peek between the branches and see a house if you squinted. I was walking my dog. There were these teenagers in the park, and they were just on the swings. I had passed by them a couple times. And then when I entered the walking path, which is, you know, once you get into the trees, you can't see, you know, anybody walking there. You kind of just disappear. As I'm kind of cresting a hill, I look behind and I see both teenagers that I had passed several times at a dead sprint coming towards me. And that sent like a spike of fear in my heart that they're going to catch me on, you know, the other side of the lake. And just, I don't know. I had a very large dog with me, so I shouldn't have been scared, but it was an unreasonable fear. But I ended up running most of that walk with my dog because I was just certain I was going to, you know, be part of some initiation or something like that. Turns out didn't happen. They were gone when I came back around, but I would say that was the last time I was scared.
Seems legit to me. You know, in the immortal words of My Chemical Romance, teenagers scare the living shit out of me. I used to work in youth offending, in an admin role, nothing. I wasn't hands-on with the kids, but it was made aware to me how underdeveloped the sort of 16 to 20-year-old male brain is, like you say. And when those same people start lifting weights and getting much stronger and taller than me, yeah, it's a frightening proposition.
Exactly. And I'll be responsible for whatever happens because yeah. I'm 40.
Yeah. One final question just for you before we go. What do you think took the heads of those prospectors in the Nahanni?
Oh, man. That's a fun one because, you know, I'm going to go with what the Dene said. I think it was giants. Mm. I don't know what else would, you know, and that's a little bit silly, but I can't think of another predator because there's only so many of them up there that would leave food on the table, that would just take the prize. And that seems like a very much a human thing to do. So, yeah, it's an uninhabited space. There are lots of caves. I'm going to stick with giants.
Seems legit to me. I'm just going to put hair on those giants and call that giant Sasquatch, but it's basically the same answer, right?
Yeah.
There we go. Yeah. Everyone, flock, Wikipedia, Nahanni Valley, and also read LP's novella. It's been a pleasure, mate. People go on about, oh, I'm so honoured to be on the show, blah de, blah de, blah de, blah. It's just nice to have a chat to people who are the same interest as me. So thank you ever so much for coming on. By God, did I love these stories. I really, really love them, despite what that may say about me when people read them. But for now, until I see you again, thank you for talking scared.
Thank you, Neil.
Wowee, this is a good collection. It gave me a very similar feeling, actually, to when I read Tyler Jones' Burn the Plans way back in episode 81. Back then, I said something about the feeling of finding a great imagination in utero, or something equally obnoxious. Anyway, LP's stories gave me that same sense of discovery. It feels like he's a writer on the very cusp of something. And I particularly admire both the variety of story on offer and his confidence in just telling the damn things. I'm on a bit of a non-pretension kick in horror at the moment, and next week's episode will bring this up again in novel form. But LP has a story, it has a purpose, and he tells it well. He picks when to let the language do the heavy lifting, and those choice similes and metaphors that I quoted show he can do it damn well, but he doesn't seem to feel the need to hide the cracks in his stories with verbiage. And frankly, I just love that. Now, they aren't all absolute winners, because I've never read a short story collection in which every story is. I mean, I've just been on a Stephen King story binge, and there are some absolute duds, even in his great collections. But there are no duds here. LP's hit ratio is absolutely A star. Do tread carefully, though. Because, as I think we made clear, he does not fuck around in a handful of these. Family Annihilator had me appalled. In the best way, but still, ouch. I enjoy the thought of LP walking around his neighbourhood with his giant dog, fleeing teenagers, with a smile on his face that makes him look all nice and beatific, all the while plotting the most hideous of scenarios. That delights me, because I do exactly the same with a much smaller dog. I am very interested in the topic of veterans in horror. And I've spoken to a few listeners and patrons about this, actually, how there seems to be a disproportionate lack of both authors and characters with military backgrounds. Now, we mentioned John Milas's The Militia House, which I need to read. I've heard wonderful things about it. Rachel Harrison said it was great, and I trust her implicitly. Haven't read it yet. I do know there's a whole subgenre of military horror, thinking of Jonathan Mabry's Joe Ledger stories, for instance. But apart from that silo, it's just an area that feels underrepresented. Now, it's easy to theorise, but I have an idea the reason is probably more complex than any simple psychological rationale of you can't put the horror of war on the page. I think it's more than that. So if you have any recommendations for horror stories that feature vets or modern war, send them in. TalkingScaredPod@gmail.com or find me on all the socials at TalkScaredPod. There's actually a great example of a veteran in King's new collection, You Like It Darker. I mean, it's in that story that he first mentioned on this show, The Dreamers, which is a nightmarish, pun intended, Lovecraftian tale of things beyond the rim of the universe. Now, if you follow me on social, you'll have seen me obnoxiously posting about having an early review copy of the collection. I really can't say much about it now because of embargo, but I'll be doing a whole special deep dive into my thoughts on those stories, one by one, very soon on Patreon, which is a good juncture for me to reiterate that you can join the Patreon and get all the extra stuff. I'm still not calling it content. Just go to patreon.com/talkingscaredpod and sign up, and thank you. And if not that, do me a favour and leave a review of the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Many thanks. I'm back next week, as I said, with another unpretentious and quite brilliant storyteller. It's Alan Baxter, the Aussie Don of horror. His novel, Blood Covenant, is billed as a blend of The Shining and Michael Mann's Heat. You're interested now, right? Check back in for that next week. Until then, push yourself a little, but keep yourself grounded and find what humour you can in the horror of the world. Read good books and remember, it's good to be scared.